Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast from Dublin City University. I'm Ciarán Dunn.
I'm Joe Binetti.
And I'm Tim Hannigan. In this series, we talk to academic experts on creativity, creative practitioners, people from the creative industries and the arts, and those working across disciplines and at the boundaries between scholarship and practice.
The aim of these conversations is to dig into creativity, to figure out what it means, and above all, to explore ways to encourage it in any field or discipline.
The Crania Project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education.
I surveyed the literature, and what emerged for me were these three paradigms of creativity and the way people talked about it. So I call them the he, the I, and the we. So the he paradigm is a paradigm of the genius.
Today we are in conversation with Vlad Glavanu. He's an associate professor and head of the Department of Psychology and Counseling at the Webster University Geneva, associate professor at Bergen University, Norway, and director of the Webster Center for Creativity and Innovation. His work focuses on creativity, imagination, culture, collaboration, and societal changes. He has been the editor and co-editor of several publications and author of numerous academic articles. In 2018, he received the Berlin Award from the American Psychological Association for outstanding early career contributions to the field of aesthetics, creativity, and the arts. Among his forthcoming publications, as part of the very short introduction series published by the Oxford University Press, there is Creativity, a very short introduction. Dear Vlad, you're very welcome. With us today, we are absolutely delighted to have you as a guest, and we really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with us and discuss the fascinating and unruly topic of creativity.
Thank you so much. I'm honored. Thank you.
As always, we would like to start our discussion with this question. What single word, which can act as a starting point for our discussion, do you associate with the concept of creativity?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Actually, I'm using it in my classes, so that it's a perfect question to start with. Because for me, the single word that I would associate most would be difference, not necessarily originality or novelty, which are very common and people think about, but difference.
Why this word?
Why? Right. Because, you know, when you think about creativity, I mean, people think about the product, what's being created, or they think about the person. They think about who is doing the creating. But actually, at the core of it, you know, it's the creative process. And we have to think about what is the engine of that process in a way. What is the core atom of creativity? And also, what is the quality of what is being produced through the process? And for me, differences are a fundamental condition for creativity to take place. You know, creativity produces a difference in the world through the ideas, objects, practices, and whatever we create. And it also emerges out of diversity. If we don't have a diversity of perspectives, at the very least, we wouldn't be able to create.
It still looks like that providing a definition of creativity is a difficult task. Mm-hmm. And the literature right. shows so. Why do you think it's so difficult to come up with a definition for creativity, if it is?
Right. Well, actually, I come from psychology, and obviously creativity is studied by a variety of disciplines. Psychologists have been very good at positioning themselves, you know, as the some of the main scholars and researchers doing creativity studies. And in psychology, we have this definition that is a product definition. And it's quite old now. It emerged in the 50s, or at least it's solidified around the, you know, 1950s. And it talks about this double criterion of creativity. So something to be creative needs to be, on the one hand, novel and original, which are very close, but not the same thing. So things that are novel are produced now, you know, but you can produce now things through mechanical reproduction, for instance. They are novel, but they're not original. So originality is the difference, or the distance, you know, coming back to difference, by the way, between what existed before and what is being made now. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have this notion of appropriateness, value, usefulness. I prefer to call it meaningfulness, really, because, and we might go on to talk about that, creativity is not only about concrete value, you know, reduced to, let's say, economic value, but it has a certain kind of meaning and a certain kind of value for our development as people. So that's a definition that existed for a long time. And I think if you talk to psychologists, they're going to say, we know the definition. Don't say that we don't. The problem is that when you want to apply it in practice, you notice that it doesn't tell you anything about the processes through which we create. So it is a useful definition if you want to do experimental studies and, you know, to measure creativity, but it is lacking in context and process.
Thank you. Given that we want to have creativity related very much with educational practices and especially higher education, I would like, from what you just said now, just start to move our conversation in that direction. You said there are indeed different approaches to the study of the notion of creativity. Do you think there is, among these approaches, there is one that is more relevant from a pedagogical perspective?
Right. Yes, there definitely, you know, everything could be relevant from a pedagogical perspective as long as it sheds a new light on creativity. So the approaches vary from very biological approaches that look at neuroscience and creativity in the brain to more sociocultural approaches. And I'm in the sociocultural side of the spectrum, if you want. So I'm very much interested in how our context, you know, the culture we're immersed in. And I'm not talking here about culture as in, you know, Irish culture versus Swiss or Romanian culture, but culture is an environment that helps us grow, you know, as human beings with language and objects and values. So if you study creativity like that in a sociocultural approach, I think it's very close to what educators know about creativity. Because when you approach creativity from the angle of education, you cannot look only at the individual or at the brain of the individual. First of all, we don't have the means, right, to study the brain in the classroom. Maybe one day we will, maybe technology will evolve, but we do see the environment. We do see social interactions. The whole idea of education is actually a social interaction, right, between teachers and students and then fellow students and fellow teachers, learning and creating together. So I feel that I might be biased here. The sociocultural approach is very fruitful from an educational perspective.
Yes, actually, could you tell us a little bit more about your perceived benefits of a sociocultural approach to creativity within an educational context?
Right. Very good question. So basically, you know, if I'm to describe it in a nutshell, you know, very quickly, I think it's a more contextual, holistic and systemic approach to creativity. So it takes away some of these old myths that we have, you know, and we carry still with us. For instance, that creativity is something that only very special people possess, that it's something that is within you. You know, the locus of creativity, the place of creativity is either the brain or a special cognitive structure or personality. Of course, all of these participate. You know, no one will deny that the brain, personality or intellect participate to creativity. But the sociocultural approach places the act of creation in an in-between space, you know, rather than within. So I feel that already that for education, as I mentioned before, that is fundamentally driven by social relations in the way we teach and learn, is already very fruitful. The second thing is that it also adopts a more developmental perspective on creativity. So this is the history of the field, you know, with names like Lev Vygotsky, you know, very, very prominent, both in psychology and in education, and also writing about creativity, you know, very early on. And the developmental part is this interest in not only what you create right now, but how that act of meaning making and creativity contributes to a longer history of you as a person. So looking at acts of creativity within a developmental context. And I think that's, again, very, very useful for education. And finally, if I'm to add another element, it's the material one. So a lot of literature on creativity is very much focused on the mind. You know, we have creative thinking. We have all sorts of societal metaphors like the light bulb, right, turning on, and that's a symbol of creativity. This reduces creativity to moments of insight that are very personal and psychological. And of course we have insights, but these insights are integrated within practical, concrete action and interaction in the world. So you use objects and places and spaces. I mean, if you look at students creating, I you know, the way I like to create, I have a piece of paper very often. I draw and I make maps and I doodle and artists make prototypes and so on. Where is that material element in the theory of creativity? So these elements, the social, the temporal, developmental, the material, I think they're great assets of the sociocultural approach.
So what you're saying, and correct me now, by putting creativity in a social context, we can take some of the attention away just from within the individual and start thinking about the relationships that can actually foster creativity as well. And that's something that can be very apparent in a classroom as well, right?
Right, absolutely. And just to mention, because I feel the sociocultural approach is often, within psychology at least, attacked as a sociological rather than psychological approach, as if it's ignoring the mental dynamic. And again, this is really not the intention. You know, if we follow back a Vygotskian line, everything that happens within the person happens also between people. And there is always a communication between these two. So it's a very social view of the human mind. You know, the sociocultural approach is not anti-individual, it's anti-individualism or anti-individualistic thinking, which is often very reductionist. It focuses us, the unit of analysis becomes the person alone. And for a socioculturalist, the unit of analysis is the interaction, you know, so it's the system, basically.
Would you say that by focusing on the individual, one may run into the risk also of focusing on that kind of creativity as being defined as big C, so the sort of eminent expression of creativity? And in doing so, don't you think there is a risk of seeing creativity as something that cannot be nurtured? And altogether, do you think that creativity can be nurtured?
Right, right. So just to pick up a bit on the big C remark, because it's very useful. You know, when I started studying creativity, when I started doing my PhD some 10 years ago, I think now, I surveyed the literature, and what emerged for me were these three paradigms of creativity and the way people talked about it. So I call them the he, the I, and the we. So the he paradigm is a paradigm of the genius. And it's not, I didn't intend it at all as a sexist name, but rather to show that the ideology of who we recognize as geniuses in society has always been biased towards men. You know, women have been effectively excluded, really, from this discourse of high-level creativity for many, many centuries. So this is extremely individualistic, and it morphed into an I paradigm in about the 1950s when psychology started, being very interested in the topic. And it became very democratized. Everyone has creative potential, men, women, children, you know, everyone. Some people even talk about animals and creativity, but it's not a social or a socialized paradigm. You know, it's still each and every person alone. So there is a big historical connection indeed between eminent creativity views of the genius and the I paradigm. Everyone is creative on his or her own. And that takes me, you know, the we paradigm to your second part of the question, which is, can we nurture creativity? So in the he paradigm, not really, because a lot of those assumptions, which again are wrong scientifically, actually, are that intelligence is purely hereditary. Galton, you know, in the 19th century, who started working on creative genius, he had the book called Hereditary Intelligence. So it was a strong assumption that you are born with it, right? The I paradigm is much more favorable for education and interventions, because it was actually meant to be a way of saying, let's cultivate creativity in every person. But what are the means to do that? You know, it's the we paradigm, at least for me, that tells you what to do as well, which is cultivate climates for creativity, cultivate context for creativity. Don't focus only on the individual alone, you know.
Thank you. You mentioned several things, and I have so many questions to ask you, but I will try to stay focused. you've been mentioning creativity in relation with culture and gender as well.
Right.
What sort of relation there is between creativity, culture, and gender? And in a way, to expand that, there is a difference in creativity throughout the lifespan of a person.
Right, right. I mean, these are all very big questions. You know, a lot of research has gone into them. And what we know now is that there is no difference. I mean, let me nuance that, because the culture discussion is very, has been very prominent. And for a long time, you know, it has been a longstanding assumption that Eastern cultures, more collectivistic cultures, are much more into conformity, right? And not so much into risk-taking and respecting, you know, tradition and authority. So a bit of anti-creativity. So there has been work that claims, you know, using divergent thinking tests and so on, and also cultural observations, that it might be less, there might, you know, people might be less creative there just because of the cultural environment. Of course, here we go back to how we define creativity, right? So remember, I don't place as much emphasis on originality alone. You know, there is a Western view of creativity that says that to be creative means to be completely out there, to be completely unique, borderline bizarre, you know, the more original, the better. But that's not the only way to understand creativity. And if you remember, we talked about these two pillar definition of creativity, which has the meaningfulness part. So for me, different cultures might emphasize different aspects of creativity. You know, in an Eastern context, it might be the meaningfulness and practicality of it that comes to the fore, which doesn't make it less creative. It makes it creative differently, if you want. Of course, today we live in a very globalized world. So it's another very interesting question to see how discourses and practices of creativity travel in between cultures and how things transform. But I do worry that it is mainly a Western tradition that pushes us to think of creativity in terms of, you know, breaking with the past rather than continuing it in a new way. And I feel that we're missing a lot, including in education, if we do that. I mean, just a practical consequence of that, you know, teachers don't advise, obviously, their students to break with the past, because in the classroom, you're supposed to learn, right? So you have to know what happened. You have to know the past if you want. If we are to operate with this definition of creativity as a break with the past, then it has no room in the classroom. You know, you're going to create later on. I mean, just learn now, learn what is, and then you'll create, you'll do whatever you want with it. But if you operate with the definition of creativity as continuing and transforming what is, that happens already in the classroom. The act of learning is an act of creativity. So you see how these big metaphors and big paradigms, you know, that operate at a cultural level as well, can have very, very big consequences. When it comes to gender, I'm not, you know, what I know is that, and I've never heard that there is a difference between men and women in terms of creativity. I didn't hear about differences in how they express creativity. Probably, you know, when you look at the intersection between culture and gender, you're going to find that men and women are directed towards different kind of spaces and domains where they're encouraged to be more creative. And when you look at the life course, here is a lot of work, you know, started from Torrance and other colleagues who famously said that around 7 years of age and then 10 years of age, you have these slumps, this kind of downfall, you know, in creativity. You have a reduction of creative expression. And they it's often related with the fact that you enter new cycles of education that require you as a child to adapt, you know, tend to respect rules more. And also with some cognitive development, you know, at different ages, you enter different stages of mental development. But again, from my perspective, you know, it really depends what's the measuring stick there. And I feel that as psychologists and educators, we need to be really mindful to how we define creativity, because that has consequences. You know, how you define relates to how you measure, relates to how you intervene to cultivate. So it's a direct line.
In what you said, I can almost see a red thread. You mentioned here and there some of the myths and stereotypes about creativity that to an extent can hinder its effects. Right. How can we dispel them?
Well, that's a perfect question, especially how we can, you know, dispel them. I'm going to start with what we discussed before, because it's really strong, this tendency to individualize creativity in a radical, radical way. So I'm going to, you notice probably that I'm avoiding to make very harsh judgments, because every approach has its own logic and history. So for instance, in today's culture, we often think of creativity as self-expression, especially in the West, right? That's why divergent thinking tests, which are these tests that ask you to generate as many ideas as you can for a given object, they're tests of self-expression, aren't they, at the end of the day? And this has a long history that goes back at least to Romanticism and the way in which creativity was connected to the arts and even to madness, you know, the mad genius, the mad artist. That is a strong cultural paradigm that we still carry with us today. Now, there is a benefit to that. You know, just let me mention that before I go into the the downside. The benefit is that, you know, some therapists, and that there's a long tradition in therapy, in humanistic therapies, especially, you know, Carl Rogers and others, who emphasize that when you connect with your personal inner creative potential, you achieve psychological health, you know, and well-being. And I completely see the argument there. The issue is that if you zoom in only on the person, right? You enter this very individualizing discourse that also feeds into another kind of appropriation of creativity, which is a very neoliberal capitalist appropriation. So individuals are creative. Let's use their creativity to produce more in society, to consume more, to drive, you know, towards progress. That is very much, why do we talk so much about creativity today? It's a very neoliberal obsession, because that's the engine of production and consumption and all of that. So that you see how it's appropriated, this discourse of personal growth can play into the hands of an economic view of the world that is very much focused on consumption, creative destruction, glorifying the individual. What is the risk here? Because some people might think, well, isn't that all great? You know, you're expressive, you're healthy, you're productive. That's perfect. You might get rich doing it. You know, what's wrong with that? The danger is that if you place creativity only within the person, then you make him or her responsible for their achievements, you know? Because if you fail to be creative, if you fail to live by the neoliberal standards of be creative, achieve things in life, because you don't look at the system around, right? You don't look at ways in which you can be effectively put down, even if you're a very creative person, it's not as simple as that. Then it becomes the burden, you know, that's why in creative industries, so many people are going to burnout, because it's a burden. You have to use your own creativity to create. Why aren't you being creative? So this is the dark side, I think, of these discourses. While if you approach it from this we paradigm, sociocultural point of view, you look at how to cultivate relationships for creativity. You look at creativity as a way not only of building economic profit, but building community, building connections between people. So it has a bit of a different history, and I think it takes us into a different place. And we have to just be mindful, yeah, of these consequences.
What you just said is incredibly clear. So the question now is, what sort of factors would you take into account so to create an environment that is fertile for the growth and blossoming of creativity, especially in students?
Right, right. Oh, great question. So we have to preface it, you know, in a very academic-like way with the disclaimer that, of course, there is no one recipe for creativity. I mean, it would be very sad in a way if we had one. And I think it wouldn't lead us to creativity. It would lead us to something else, because by definition, creativity relies on that difference, you know. So applying the same method won't lead you to more difference. So thinking of that, though, there are some general principles that can be extremely useful. And, you know, if we think about cultivating difference, because let's go on with this assumption, right, that creativity does depend on being aware of differences, valuing them, and acting on them in new ways, in creative ways, then what does it mean to create a classroom or a university environment where people can be confident and trusting that they can express their different opinion, right? I mean, think about the paradigms of education and how it moved and it shifted a long way from seeing the teacher as the complete seat of authority in the classroom and education as a very unidirectional act of teacher knows, transfers knowledge to student, now student knows. Nowadays, we acknowledge much more the interactive and bidirectional nature of education, including in higher education, of course. Now, the question of creativity is, how can we make room for diverse and marginal and sometimes, you know, kind of opposite views? Because the teacher often, including university teachers, ask questions that are what's called known questions. They know the answer to them very often. It is very rare that a teacher would ask an unknown question for him or herself. Because what teachers generally don't like is chaos in the classroom or losing control. I mean, that's a very human need, right? To have things predictable and ordered and organized. And we usually think of teachers as these masters of ceremony for the classroom. They have to put on this performance in a Goffmanian kind of sense, this show of control and authority. Even if it's a subtle authority nowadays, and that authority comes from knowledge. So one direct way, just one tool I can think about, is allowing not knowing into the classroom. Not fake or pretense not knowing, when I actually know, but I'm trying to see if you get to know what I know. But genuine, open questions, you know, that would be an amazing kind of progress. How many times do teachers go in the classroom and think, I want to learn something from this? I'm not here only to teach. I mean, I'm here to guide and, of course, convey information and so on. But I want to learn as well. I think if we change that mentality, I mean, that would be already amazing progress. And then you have, you know, you have research by colleagues of mine from Bergen University, like Ingun Ness, who discovered working with multidisciplinary groups, that openness, curiosity, and respect are fundamental kind of preconditions for greater creativity in such groups. So being open to diverse opinions, being able to respect them, which is not agreeing, by the way. That's another big misconception, thinking of, you know, myths and misconceptions. When we think of different perspectives, we don't need to say, I agree with you, but I want to hear you and understand where you're coming from. That's a very, very different thing. And if you give space to people, you know, for people to express that, you're going to enrich your own understanding. Even if it doesn't change your mind, you're going to have a more open and flexible and wide mental space, you know, around that issue. So there is an issue of respecting difference, being curious as well, being genuinely curious about other people. And that is a skill that we need to cultivate, not only in teachers, in students as well. We teach them to be curious about so many things in the world. Hopefully we teach them to do that, you know, through mathematics, geography, whatever is being taught. Can we teach them to be curious about other people, about their own mind, about differences in how people look at the world and see the world? That is a big, big part of how, you know, they're going to get resources to be creative.
Yes, I see that. I would like to go back a little bit what you said at the beginning of your answer about the relationship and the roles, especially teachers and students play in a classroom, which is indeed standardized in itself. So you were mentioning the fact the teacher normally is the one who delivers the knowledge, and students are those that receive this knowledge and just take it in and memorize it. And this happens in a way from a very early age. There's been research showing, as you mentioned actually before, with the age of 6-7, there is a decrease in creativity in children, and partially could be because they start the path within formal education that somehow requires to play this role. Students become often enough a little bit passive in the learning process, even though things are changing now. And yes, indeed, there is a call for more creativity in education. However, it's quite widespread that by the time students arrive at the university level, they went basically through more than half of the formal education, and somehow they've been imprinted in a certain way. You were mentioning the fact that it would be great for teachers. How often do teachers enter a classroom saying, I would like to know the answer to this question that I actually don't know? Then there is also another problem, because there is a problem of testing and marking, which is a huge part of our educational system, I'd say. Do you see this thing? Do you see like the fact that by the time students are at the university level, there might be already frame of mind, way of thinking that have hindered a blossoming of creativity in them?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is something we know, including from maybe our own life experience in some ways. There are different cycles of education that have different relationships to creativity. But again, you know, we need to be careful and think of a certain kind of creativity. So in this case, self-expressive type of creativity, because creativity can also be more disciplined. You know, again, if you think about novelty and originality and meaningfulness, students produce those things on a moment-to-moment basis. You know, this is the mini C and little C in the literature. It's not big C, but it's still very important. So I think, first of all, we shouldn't throw the baby with the bathwater and acknowledge that even in very standardized formal classrooms, there are new ideas that come about for students and so on. We don't make the most of them, though, and we don't have a practice of nurturing them to their full potential. That is definitely the case. But just to say that, yes, you can see how in kindergarten, expressive creativity is the norm. You know, that's where the environment is cozy and nice and colorful and so on, according to the stage of development. Of course, we know why we put so many objects and colors and so on. But then the more you move into education, at least when I did my education, and I do acknowledge that classrooms have changed quite a bit, it was much more austere, right? You don't have stuff on the walls. I mean, you have maps and all and photos of famous people, but it becomes, you know, the norm is to become disciplined. The aim of education in many ways is to create you as a more or less obedient, good citizen, you know. And I think what we need, and this is where education and society go so much hand in hand, because changes in society will always impact education. Like, look at the emergence of technologies nowadays, right? New technologies and social media. You can't do education as you used to. It's impossible. Like, students are online most of the time. How are you going to acknowledge that? How are we going to use that? But also, education has a great role in shaping society, because it does form future citizens. So I feel that what we need is an acknowledgement of students' creative agency from much, much earlier on, not to wait for them to come to university. Normally then you have a reopening in that sense. Normally then teachers come back and say critical thinking is on, you know, it's being marked for, so express your idea. But it is not too late, but it can create uncomfortable ruptures for students and unnecessary ruptures. If only we applied more consistently these principles, I think, yeah, we would definitely go a longer way.
Thank you. Once again, you mentioned many things and I'll try to stay focused. Again, I would like to move a little bit forward our discussion as well. We touched this topic before. You've been talking about creativity and within different domains. Mm-hmm. So I will not ask you whether creativity is domain specific, but else, do you think there are certain disciplines where it's more difficult to foster creativity?
That is a good and trick question, you see, because again, you know, it will depend on how you define it. I can definitely say that there are disciplines that are at the forefront of fostering creativity, that, you know, that integrated within the identity of the discipline and what it means to do art, for instance. You know, art comes to mind first and foremost. They integrated the discourses and practices of creativity. And they're disciplines that are kind of have an ambivalent relation to creativity. Most other academic disciplines in some ways, you know, at least in the primary cycles of education. And they're disciplines who, sadly, they have a societal reputation of being almost opposed to creativity. So a lot of people think of math as something you have to know, and it's a strict set of rules, and you need to just be very smart, you know, analytically smart, but not too creative. That is completely wrong, right? I think about Einstein, and we have so many quotes from him, memorable quotes about imagination and creativity. I mean, you can be enormously creative within mathematics. We don't usually foster that in the classroom because of these misconceptions, but it is definitely there. It's a possibility. Some time ago, together with another colleague, we wrote about identity and creativity, and we thought about, you know, promoted creative identities and some kind of forbidden creative identities, if you want, you know, where people struggle to have a claim to creativity. And I think in that paper, we also had interviews reported from teachers, you know, math teachers and art teachers and things like that. And you could see how the art teachers were so comfortable with the topic. Of course, they would shine, you know, when it comes to creativity. And math teachers would struggle and had to justify themselves, or even to step back and say, you know, this is not really my aim in my class. So what do we take from here, right? I think the idea is that there are no more or fundamentally creative and fundamentally uncreative domains. I think you can always make room for differences and appreciation of differences and new perspectives, whatever the domain. But the way we teach disciplines, you know, has a history to it. And things are changing a lot nowadays. I do appreciate that. But it still has this weight of knowledge comes first before creativity, instead of going hand in hand with creativity.
Then there is a very, very obvious question I need to ask you. Having said all these, as educators, what can we do to promote a culture of creativity and cultivate students' creative competences?
Right. Well, first of all, we have a lot of power, you know, to act in this domain, in this area. But you remember from the we paradigm that it's a relation, it's bidirectional. So we don't have just one seat of responsibility here. I think everyone should be encouraged to think about that, you see. So we often think of teachers, what can you do? But I think we need to work with students rather than on the students when it comes to creativity, you know, to truly collaborate. Because we might fall back into this very unidirectional discourse of I, as a teacher, thought what you need to create, you know, and this might be it. So of course, we don't want to do that. And of course, here we're talking about general principles. And yes, teachers have more power in the classroom. It's obvious, right? So when it comes to that, you know, we mentioned already the openness to difference. It's a concept that I worked on with another colleague, Ron Baghetto. And allowing the not knowing to come into the classroom. And we didn't touch upon the physical organization of classrooms, because you asked me that as well. And I think it's a very interesting question. When it comes to the traditional classroom, at least when I was in school, benches very much separate and they were stuck to the floor. And more you notice these flexible arrangements nowadays. And I've been visiting, you know, very modern schools that really embrace the discourse of creativity. And they've done completely away with the notion of this is your seat in the classroom. No, they have this communal long table, a lot of chairs around, and then you grab a chair, you know, and then you have your stuff in a specific place. Of course, you need to put your bags and books and so on. So it's not like you're completely nomad in the classroom, but using the physicality of the classroom to encourage movement. You know, we didn't touch much upon movement, but this is another current little obsession of mine, the connection between movement, mobility, and creativity. And that goes such a long way in the classroom. We used to have this view of seated bodies, you know, just sitting down and listening. And at younger kind of children and primary cycles, teachers acknowledge that by 15 minutes, they have to go run because it's, you know, that you can't control them. With students, we still have this assumption that they can go hours just sitting there, you know. So there is something problematic with higher education in respect to mobility. If you go back to what I said, you know, creativity has difference and different perspectives. How do we develop a new perspective? By repositioning ourselves. We need to adopt new positions in the world. And this position starts by having physical repositioning. You know, we need movement because there is a bit of a mirroring effect between wandering around in the classroom and wandering around mentally. You know, they don't have to happen at the same time, but there is a kind of a thread there, as you mentioned at some point about, you know, red threads. So there is a lot teachers could do. They could basically kind of open up this power structure and make it more horizontal. They could be more participative. They could invite different contributions. They could genuinely want to say, I want to know who thinks differently, you know, and in an open way, not as making a pedagogical example out of it. And they can work with the physicality of the classroom. So the way you arrange the benches and the people's places there, and the way you create in an embodied way, not only in a mental way. And of course, then you have these new technologies that come in and education is now being taken over. I mean, the pandemic accelerated all of that, right? The Zooms and the Skypes and the whatever other means people use. And virtual reality is coming in as well. And I feel here as a creativity researcher and partially an educator, of course, that we shouldn't fetishize these new technologies. I feel that for many people, the fact that you have them, you have 3D printers, you have virtual reality headsets, this is it, you know, you're going to be creative. No, it's not as simple. It's how you use them. You can have a very simple classroom setting with very traditional artifacts, with the old board and, you know, chalk to draw and so on. And you can do amazing things for creativity just with that. So it doesn't rest within the technology, but technology really invites us to think outside of the box. So that should be a weapon, if you want, or, you know, maybe a tool more benevolent in the toolkit of teachers.
So in a way, creativity rests on the agency of both students and teachers and their ability of understanding the differences in, I would say, almost creativities, plural. Mm-hmm. And that's, you actually started by saying there is not one recipe for creativity. Is more a matter of finding your own recipe?
Yes, well, it's a matter of understanding your context, right? And understanding who's the teacher, who are the students, what is their life trajectory? We talked a little bit about embedding creativity within the life course, because students come to the classroom with such diverse life experiences and such diverse concerns and questions. You know, that's the beginning. That's where you start. You can't come and say, brainstorming, fantastic method, let's go with it. What is the brainstorming question? What kind of differences can you make salient that are favorable or kind of conducive for that particular question? So you really need to know personally and culturally who you're working with somehow, and the institutional norms and what you can do within them. And teachers know that, you know, it's very much either implicit or explicit knowledge about all of these things. I think it's a matter of them trying to look for small opportunities where creativity can flourish. A lot of teachers think this goes against the curriculum. You know, you touched upon very briefly assessment and the cultures of assessment. This goes against what I should be doing now. I need to teach them X, Y, and Z because they're going to be evaluated on that. And I will be consequently evaluated on, you know, their outcomes. So there is a lot of pressure there to conform and go with one set way of doing things. But there are so many opportunities to get to the same point by using different methods, different pathways. So even when in education you have the same outcome that you're striving for, the way you get there can be enormously creative.
Thank you very much. We are having a very, very long and interesting discussion that is slowly and most unfortunately coming to an end. I will ask you one final question, which I'm sure may require a very, very long answer, but I'll ask you to almost give a bullet point answer to this question. If you had a magic wand, what would you change so as to promote creativity in education?
Wow. You took me already in a very Harry Potter universe over there. So what would I promote? A very specific thing I would change. Whew, that is a difficult one, right? Because it's the system we talked about. But let me give you that bullet point. Let me focus on it. It's almost a creativity task in and of itself, what you're doing here. I think what I would do, okay, I've chosen. I've chosen one thing. I think I would work at the level of mindsets, you know, for creativity. I think those myths and assumptions we talked about, they're really weighing on people's ability to see that there can be so much more that is being done. So, you know, we in the literature, we know from Carol Dweck and all the studies on the fixed and kind of growth mindset, there is a growth creativity mindset where you basically notice all of these differences and relationships and don't think in terms of unique geniuses and revolutionary creations only. And if we could change that, I think we would have like some kind of lenses kind of taking off from our eyes and see the world in such a different way. Because the world and the classroom being, you know, a microcosm of the world, is inherently dynamic. It's inherently emergent. Think of conversations in the classroom. You know, think of our conversation now. We don't know I don't know what I'm going to say next. You know, probably something and you'll say something very interesting in return. But we don't know what that is. Isn't that an amazing example of creativity? But we don't think of that in this way because we are trapped in this more fixed, individualistic, genius-based mindset. So I feel that, yeah, I would operate first at that level.
Thank you so much. That was a brilliant insight. One final question I would like to ask you. There is a book that is about to be published. Right. If you know the actual date, please tell us because I was not clear on that. Different websites says different things.
Right.
I was wondering, so, well, the very short introductions is a very well-renowned series by the Oxford University Press. What has guided you, like, given the complexity of the notion of creativity, what has guided you in writing this short introduction?
Excellent question. Well, you know, exactly this idea, if I had a magic wand, how would I write a guide, you know, a short guide? It was a challenge because this book series, first of all, is very short, as the title says, it's very concise, and it needs to be very accessible. And I hope that even in this interview, you know, we talked very concrete things, but it is a challenge to make some more complex ideas sometimes, you know, more easily graspable. But for me, this guide comes exactly from the sociocultural angle. So if someone wants to, you know, we'll get to read this book, they're going to maybe be a bit surprised that it doesn't talk only about the brain and creativity, you know, the personality structure and creativity, intelligence and creativity. These are all there, but it's also about culture. It's also about society. It's also about history. It's also about these discourses of creativity. It's also asking at the end of the book, the question of why we create. You know, it's such an important question. We don't often stop and think about it, do we? We just take it for granted. Well, creativity, it's great. You know, just go on doing it. Why do we do it? So that guided me. I think I wanted to do a different kind of short intro.
Thank you so much for your time, Vlad. We are now coming to the end of our conversation. There will be so much more to discuss. I would like to invite you if you have any final remark.
This is my time. Now, I think what's most interesting to me about creativity is how it tells us so much more about ourselves as human beings and about society. And when you have a definition or a view of creativity, it actually articulates with how you see yourself and your agency and your capacities as a human being and how you see the world and the role of society. So I think we need a deep reflection on these connections, because we often focus way too much on novelty, originality, and so on. So yeah, that would be my message.
Thank you so much. And on this note, thank you very much for coming and all the best.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Thank you.